Minutes behind time. If I may ask all the panelists who are listed here to come and join us here at the front.
Those guys at the back there are not in. That's a friend at the back. Oh, is that where tea is?
If we may ask people to sit down so that we may start with the session, please, especially the guys on my right at the back who are enjoying tea. Could we settle down so that we start with the next session, please?
Look at Alan.
Okay, I think let us begin. Those who are standing will be joined. We'll sit down just now. The next session, which is the last session for the day under legal issues, cross-border domain registrations, I'm moderating the session. I know on the program we listed Mr. Lakima Silela, whom I believe most of you saw him this morning when he delivered an opening speech on behalf of Zetna, the host. I'll be moderating this session in his place. My name is V. Gampisane, the General Manager of the ZA Domain Name Authority. We have as our panelists, as listed on the program here, Ben Crawford from Central NIC. We have Konstantinos Komaitis of Internet Society, who is here on my left. I think I know Alice Munya enough to know if she's around. Okay, so we have Alice Munya this side. well, we have Neil Dundas standing in Alice's place. And then we have online Sarah Mati, who will be the first presenter. She's joining us online. She will speak on behalf of WIPO. And then Jim Galvin of Affilias. Oh, Jim, sorry, thank you. And then my friend Mohammed Diop of Kewil.com is on the left there. I think we'll start, and I'm going to hand over to Sarah to run with the presentation. Each speaker will be given 10 minutes to do their presentations, not only because of time pressure, but also to allow some questions and discussions at the end. So each speaker will have 10 minutes. Those who are here live, there's a clock that Dan is seated with there. That is has the number of minutes that you have. So as you present, just from time to time, check that clock. It will tell you when you need to wrap up and stop. I'm going to hand over to Sarah. Sarah? Okay, Sarah, just hold on. We are, for some reason, we're struggling to hear you.
Well, we can.
All right. my name is Sarah Mati, and I'm here on behalf of the WIPO Arbitration and Mediation Center. I want to thank you for inviting me today to speak to you this afternoon. I will be presenting, my colleague had to leave this afternoon due to other commitments, so it will only be me today. I'm going to briefly talk about the WIPO domain name dispute resolution and the CCTLD program. So, on to my first slide. you will see that WIPO was established in 1994 in Geneva, and we now have an office in Singapore. Our mission is to protect IP rights and to provide ADR services. Usually we provide arbitration, mediation, and expedited arbitrations. And we also do other tailored dispute mechanisms for specific sectors. We provide publications, training programs, and conferences. As most of you may know, we also administer domain name disputes. WIPO is an ICANN dispute resolution provider. And this is the topic that I should be talking about today. So briefly, just to introduce domain names, what I can say is that domain names are not IP rights per se, but sometimes can come into conflict with trademark rights. As a result, disputes between domain name registrants and trademark owners usually occur, and as such, we need to provide a mechanism of solving such disputes. So one method of doing this is by using the UDSP process, which I am sure most of you are familiar with. The UDRP stands for Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy, and this was recommended by WIPO and was drafted by ICANN. It was adopted by ICANN in October 1999, and it's applicable for GTLDs and certain CCTLDs where CCTLD registries have adopted UDRP. The principal advantages of UDRP is that it's time and cost effective, in the sense that it does not take a lot of time. The procedure takes approximately 2 months. It's also predictable. There is a lot of jurisprudence out there, and it's also internationally enforceable. The UDRP system is based on a contract between the ICANN domain name registrars and domain name registrants. And this is used by trademarks to resolve cases of abusive registration of domain names, or the so-called cyber squatting. It allows complainants to file complaints without necessarily going to court, and at the same time preserving their court options, meaning that they could also go to court should they wish to do so. Now, briefly, the UDRP has three main requirements. That is, a complainant needs to show that a domain name is identical or confusingly similar to a trademark right that it owns, that the respondent or the registrant lacks rights or legitimate interest in domain name, and that the registration of that particular domain name was done in bad faith, and it has also been used in bad faith. The remedies provided under the UDRP are limited to transfer and cancellations, and usually there is no award of costs or monetary damages. UDRP decisions are issued by independent panel based on merit, and WIPO acts as a dispute provider, and WIPO does not really decide on the cases. This is an area that is determined by the panelists. Now, as I said previously, the process takes 2 months, and it's an online process. The complainant files a complaint with WIPO, for instance. The provider, in this case, WIPO, checks for compliance, and if WIPO finds that a complaint meets the requirements of the UDRP policy and rules, proceeds to notify the respondent, and the respondent is provided with an opportunity to file a response. The provider will appoint a panel thereafter to determine the matter, and the panelists should issue a decision in 14 days. The provider then will notify the panel decision and also notify the registrar to implement the decision. That is what you can see in front of you is the UDRP process in brief, which I am sure you will have a copy. Then in Y4, we have just provided statistics of our cases. As you can see, last year we had 2,884 cases. This year, although it's marked 635, this was actually sometime in February, March. So at this point, we have slightly over 1,000 cases. If I move on now to CCTLD registration models, we have open versus restricted models. Restricted models are whereby the eligibility criteria is restricted. For instance, only certain members can register a certain string, or certain members can, from certain jurisdictions, can register a particular domain name. The same applies to open models, where it's open in the sense that it's worldwide. For instance, .coms can be registered by anyone. Typically, the CCTLD registry is vested with authority to determine if any rights protection mechanism have been affected. So usually a CCTLD registry should maintain best practices, which we actually advocate in WIPO. For instance, we advocate that a CCTLD registry should maintain a registration agreement. We also advocate for WHOIS information, for instance. We also advocate that a CCTLD registry should have a way of resolving domain name disputes should they arise. In WIPO, we administer now about 68, but I am told that we have actually accepted a new CCTLD, so as of today it should be 69. We have 38 CCTLDs that have adopted WIPO, that have adopted UDRP. We also have about 10 or so that are from African continent. Now, the question is, why should a CCTLD adopt the UDRP? The issue is that the UDRP has been proven to be efficient, and that the UDRP is only needs to be incorporated by reference in the CCTLD registry registration agreement. Usually no changes are required. And as I mentioned earlier, advantages of the UDRP make it easier for CCTLDs to adopt it. Moving on to the variations, some CCTLDs have decided to adopt a variation of the UDRP rather than adopting the UDRP itself. So, for instance, some CCTLDs have limited the scope of applicability of the dispute resolution policy. For instance, certain CCTLDs will only require that the trademark or the trade name is registered within a certain jurisdiction, or require infringement of national IP laws. For instance, .ch.br. Some CCTLDs will require bad faith registration or use, as opposed to the UDRP, which requires both elements. some CCTLDs will require the local court to deal with matters of domain name dispute resolution. Some CCTLDs will require that a local language be used as opposed to the language of the registration agreement. Some countries have also asked that panelists be appointed from their countries rather than from all over the world. Some CCTLDs like .ch.nl have adopted a mediation element where the registry takes up a role to mediate and so forth. So there you will see a list of the CCTLDs administered by WIPO, and then those are the numbers. So as I said, we have 38 CCTLDs that have adopted the UDRP. Then we have 26 variations and 4 arbitrations. Then in Africa, we have 10 CCTLDs, that is from Angola, from Congo, Djibouti, as you can see, Morocco, Malawi, Seychelles, Sierra Leone, Somalia, and Tanzania just joined recently, and Uganda. In Africa, 7 CCTLDs have adopted the UDRP. You can see them on my slide. 3 of them have adopted a variation of the UDRP, that is Angola, Tanzania. Those are the number of cases. We have had a case from Congo, we have had 10 from Morocco, we've had 3 from Seychelles, and we've had 6 under .ESO. .TZ, which just joined recently, just briefly to mention, the TZ NIC, of course, in 2012 decided to ask WIPO to provide a dispute resolution policy. And we actually collaborated with Tanzania, and now we can actually provide disputes for them. In their policy, their language of proceeding is English, as opposed to the UDRP, which states the language of registration agreement should be the language. Their policy also requires registration or use in bad faith, unlike the UDRP, which requires registration and use in bad faith. The mutual jurisdiction election is the court of Tanzania, unlike the court of the location of the registrar, as is the case with the UDRP. So this is a good example of a variation. We also have .AO for Angola, which is also a variation. And there, as you can see, the language is English and Portuguese. And Court of Angola, that's the mutual jurisdiction election. As you can see, also the complaint has to be filed in both hard copies and in electronic format. And also, it requires registration or use of the domain name in bad faith. We have Morocco. As you can see there, the language is French. And there we only accept, we can only appoint a single member panel only. And experts have to be lawyers qualified in Moroccan law and so forth. As you can see that each CCTLD has an opportunity to tailor its own dispute mechanism as they wish. Other variations in other places include .Bihar for Brazil. We have .QA for Qatar. And we also, I believe we have others which are not mentioned here, but you can actually find them on our website. That is our website. That is where you will find all the information on CCTLDs. That is our CCTLD database, in case you want to search a country and see what they have. You can always go there. Then this is the CCTLD page again. This is what you see if you enter inside the page. For instance, this is .au, so you can get all the information about .au.
Sarah, if may be aware that you have to go.
Yes, please. And then that's our schedule of fees. If a complainant wants to file a complaint, that is where you find all the information. Just to rush through my slides, that's how a complaint would look like. And then this is our page about WIPO domain name dispute resolution. And this is our information. If you have a question that I will not be able to answer right away, you can always write to us and we can get back to you. And we also have events coming, and one of them is WIPO Advanced Workshop on Domain Name Dispute Resolution in October 29th and 30th in Geneva. So if you are interested in attending that workshop, you might want to go into that link and see the information on registration. And I think that's the end. Thank you for listening to my presentation.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for the presentation and the detail on what WIPO is doing in the dispute resolution space. We'll move on. I understand that Sarah will still be around for a while. So I think what we'll do is let's take additional presentation on this topic. I will move to Constantinos of Internet Society. Afterwards, he will be followed by Neil Dundas, still on cross-border domain disputes. Constantinos.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. And thank you all for your kind invitation. My name is Konstantinos Komaitis. I am a policy advisor at the Internet Society. However, before joining the Internet Society, I used to be an academic researching on domain names and trademarks. I even convinced the publisher at some point to release a book on that very issue. So I will be changing my hats whilst I am speaking. And the WIPO panelists said a lot about the WIPO process and the UDRP, so I will try not to be repetitive. But I would like to take us a little bit back and try to put the issue of cross-border domain name disputes into context. So in the case of domain names, from a legal perspective at least, we face the same similar challenges that we see in other areas like privacy or contract formation, etc. So we have the issue of jurisdiction. But if you want, when it comes to domain names, there is an additional hurdle, and that hurdle relates to the fact that domain names are unique. So you can only have one www.whatever, coca-cola.com or apple.com. So as you can understand, the chase of who gets there first to get the domain name, especially since domain names are being given on a first-served basis, has created a lot of demand for domain names and also has generated a lot of challenges and disputes. So going back to John Postel, who actually created the domain name system, and to the request for comments 1591, it is stated there that the registration of a domain name does not have any trademark status. That, of course, doesn't mean that companies, when registering a domain name, do not have trademark rights on that domain name. However, a domain name registration does not automatically, if you want, create trademark rights. So the issue back in 1998 and the issue that ICANN was asked to resolve related to something that was called cyber squatting, and that was the activity of various people registering various trademarks as domain names that did not belong to them, and then approaching trademark owners and other people who or entities who had rights on those names and try to sell them to make money out of it. So there was a growing demand on ICANN to come up with a system that was able to resolve this extremely problematic issue. And because courts were not, and to a certain extent, they're still not equipped to deal with internet-related matters, ICANN approached the World Intellectual Property Organization, as we heard, and they asked them to devise a policy to administer those conflicts. And in 1998, we landed with a Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy, which, as we've heard, is a very fast, cheap mechanism to resolve domain name disputes. The uniqueness and the greatest advantage of the UDRP is the fact that it manages to address the issue of jurisdiction. So the UDRP has been working, has been one of the, actually the oldest ICANN policy. It has been for the past 12 years. It has administered thousands and thousands of disputes, and it has been replicated by various CCTLDs. Now, I would like to bring a little bit this domain name disputes at the CCTLD level. There are other CCTLD registries that have come up with their own domain name dispute resolution processes, but they are all heavily based upon the UDRP model. So essentially you have two parties, the trademark owner and the respondent, who is the registrant, and each one of those parties has to comply with a set of very specific rules and go before a third neutral arbitrator or panelist, better yet, to solve the disputes. As every mechanism, especially one that is based on voluntary initiatives, the UDRP has its own challenges. Some of them are well documented out there by various people. They relate to timing. They relate to the fact that default cases, forum shopping, etc. But overall, it is a system that at least has produced very valuable lessons and has allowed various other CCTLD registers in particular to take the model and shape it according to their own needs. So talking about that and talking about setting up dispute resolution processes for country code top level domain names, the internet is a space of opportunities. It is a space where existing business models can use the space in order to promote their products and services. It is a space where new business models can emerge. And to this end, it is very important that any policies we create, be it on domain names or for any other issue, take into consideration and provide an environment that is welcoming to both existing and new business models. And why I'm saying that? Because it is very important. Law has the tendency of solving issues that appear right before us. It doesn't really think into the future. The UDRP and many CCTLD operators right now realize that businesses use domain names in order to be able and have a presence in the internet, but there are also some new businesses and some names that we haven't even discovered. So there needs to be a very clear balance between trademark rights, but also rights that can evolve over time. Let me put you before you a very concrete example. Imagine if somewhere in the world there was a trademark for Facebook or for Twitter. we wouldn't have experienced really what Facebook stands for. Maybe we would have seen Facebook under another name, or maybe we wouldn't at all. So it is very important that dispute resolution mechanisms try to take into consideration and think ahead, but at the same time, they need to comply with some very basic principles, and those relate to due process, just think it as fairness and justice, provide room for checks and balances. So a very interesting point is an internal appeals process that is able to, if you want, indirectly provide a review of the mechanism, and also allow room for self-expression in any form and in any sense. So, for example, a great example is the nominate case in the UK, where they have replicated to an extent the UDRP, but at the same time they have inserted some provisions that correspond better to their own national and cultural issues. So I will stop here because I'm very conscious of time. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Konstantinos. Neil Dundas.
Thank you, Vicar. My name is Neil Dundas. I'm the Chief Executive of the ZA Central Registry. I'm going to give you a slightly different take on alternate dispute resolution, and looking at it from an angle of the .Africa TLD that we've applied for and will be launching, all things being equal, pretty soon. We've heard from the person from WIPA and Konstantinos about the existing ADR processes out there, such as the UDRP and the URS that ICANN is introducing. And as a TLD applicant, we really have no choice in terms of implementing those processes. But what we're certainly aiming to do from our side is to ensure that we will implement a parallel concurrent system of our own, and it feeds from the following considerations. From the very beginning of the .Africa project, the project team has envisaged that it will implement, as much as it is reasonably possible, localized rights protection mechanisms and procedures. And this is based on a fundamental commitment we made to the African stakeholder community to develop African skills and capacity across the broader domain name ecosystem wherever we can. Our commitment also extends towards developing and implementing processes that are not only relevant to Africa, but also address Africa's unique circumstances and challenges. So we believe in a nutshell that the UDRP and the existing processes, whilst they're very good and do cover the fundamentals, don't always cover challenges that we may envisage or that we may encounter in the developing world. From our experience, we have seen that the intellectual property and legal communities are important participants in the domain name value chain, not only in dispute resolution processes, but also in launch processes such as the trademark sunrise process. It is therefore clear to us, this is the .Africa project team, that a successful launch of a TLD like .Africa depends on the dynamic and active participation of the African IP and legal communities. Just by means of a bit of background, in the ZA namespace in South Africa, we've implemented our own alternate dispute resolution mechanism. It was implemented in 2007, roughly 8 years after the ICANN UDRP was first implemented. And to date, it's presided over 145 cases, relating to over 170 different domain names. Of these 145 cases that have been filed, statistics show that 72% of these cases have been decided, whilst 21% have been settled. So there's an element of mediation in these processes, which is maybe unique to the African context, or perhaps it is a common thread throughout. The balance of the numbers are still pending cases. And we've also seen a gradual increase year on year of the number of cases being filed through this process. The statistics also show that 85% of all decided cases have been successful. 15% of them have been dismissed. Only 43% of these cases have been opposed. In other words, the registrant, when they've received a dispute or a complaint, have reacted on it. No, I'm just reading. have actually opposed these applications. And where they've opposed an application, we've seen that the success ratio for the complainant has dropped from 85% to 70%. And interestingly, even though the process is designed for the layman, 81% of these cases are filed through legal counsel. So why would we want to complicate our lives by implementing our own rights protection mechanisms for .Africa and the namespaces we're applying for? Especially since ICANN has already prescribed and provided minimum rights protection mechanisms such as the UDRP and the URS, which we're bound to contractually to implement. Well, as indicated before, our primary objective in terms of the .Africa project as a whole is to develop a successful African DNS ecosystem. An integral part of this ecosystem is the intellectual property and legal communities, not only from a legal perspective, but also from a business perspective. In the ZA namespace, we have seen that the IP and legal communities are significantly invested in the growth and success of the domain namespace, and we want to replicate this winning recipe for Africa. In summary, our two primary objectives would be to establish and grow an African ADR capacity, expertise, and support within the IP and legal communities so that African experts can also participate in and contribute to the DNS ecosystem. So it's about developing that capacity and those skill sets in Africa. We've done it in South Africa. We're sure we can repeat that in the rest of Africa. The second criteria is to implement an ADR process that is responsive to Africa's specific needs and challenges. And I'll use by example here in my closing remarks, in the ZA ADR regulations, we've introduced the concept of offensive registrations. And the broader context of the African context with its multiple cultures and languages, concepts such as offensive registrations could very well meet a particular challenge. We would also like to extend abusive registrations, the definition of abusive registrations, to not just include trademark abuse, but also other forms of abuse such as spam, phishing, and fraud. I know these are very tough challenges that we have to face, but we believe we can do it. And obviously, well, the other concept that we would look to bring into the .Africa ADR process is the concept we've introduced in ZA around the training and internships of experts. So you would have adjudicators presiding over cases that if they don't have the necessary experience, they can actually perform their services as an intern under a senior adjudicator, and in doing so pick up experience and gain knowledge to eventually ultimately handle these cases independently. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil Dundas. You and Konstantinos have saved us at least 5 minutes on your presentations. I'll now move on to Ben Crawford, who will present on open versus closed registries.
Hi, everybody. So I'm Ben Crawford. Thanks. So just a little bit of background about my company, CentralNEC. So we're a registry. We own a registrar. We're a registry service provider. We're currently supporting 30 domain extensions, and we've done, I think, 7 sunrises and land rushes in the past 2.5 years. The CCTLDs we're handling at the moment are .PW, which is for the island of Palau in the Pacific, and .LA, which is for the Lao People Democratic Republic in Indochina. And we're the back-end provider for 60 new GTLDs, or GTLD applications, I should say. We've got English and French and Arabic-speaking staff. We do our own in-house marketing. We're ICANN compliant and ISO 27001 accredited. We have DNSSEC across all 30 of our zones, and we have for some years. I think essentially that's who we are. So on the next slide. So I've been thinking about this open versus closed, and I actually think the words open and closed is something of a misnomer, because really all domains are restricted in some ways. Some are just restricted more than others and in different ways. So obviously we're very familiar with the .gov, and for most country codes have a .gov second level, which are very highly restricted and really very rarely, if ever, the site of any kind of legal disputes. And we're going to see the same thing with hundreds and hundreds of dot brand TLDs, the dot Sonys, the dot Googles and so on, where the entire second levels and below are controlled by a single entity. So they're kind of at the extreme of the closed. But even the most open ones are not entirely unrestricted. Neil was just talking about introducing different types of restrictions relating to phishing and fraud and so on. And certainly we do that across all of our domains and just simply say if you conduct an illegal activity, we'll take your domain from you, which is what we do. On the next slide, please. So the types of restrictions people have are obviously geographic, which is, I think, was kind of the thinking behind this, to try and limit registrants to businesses and residents of a particular country. And I think in NO and Norway is probably a very extreme version of that. Group membership is a restriction. For instance, .travel and a lot of new GTLDs have these kinds of approaches. Then you can obviously have restrictions on names. So names registered have to be business names. For instance, in Saudi, they have that in the top level. The number of names per registrant. So you might know .edu's American colleges can only have one .edu, even if they have many, many schools with different names. So there's a NYU.edu, but Stern Business School has to have Stern.NYU.edu. They can't have Stern.edu, for instance. And specific name formats, which is probably the reason behind the demise of the .museum domain, was that people were forced to include the type of museum and the location within the domain name, which basically made it extremely inelegant and unintuitive. And, of course, there are restrictions on content and restrictions on such things as who is privacy and use of proxies. Now, it made me think about launches, because I think many domains, many that we've managed, but also many of the new GTLDs that will launch are actually going to go through different phases of restrictions. And it might be something interesting to think about with CCTLDs, as many of them will, and I hope they will, jump at this short opportunity to globalise and market themselves outside of their countries before the new GTLDs launch. And so, for instance, I know we did this with domains in Japan and Germany, for instance, that we had a sunrise for local trademarks, then a sunrise for foreign trademarks. We did a land rush, then we did local registered business names. So if they weren't trademarks, but they were local business names and local residents. And, you know, there's different orders that these could happen in, and we'll be doing this again with a lot of new GTLDs. And a lot of the geos, the cities, for instance, are thinking about exactly this, that, well, maybe you should be allowed to have a .nyc if you're outside New York, but let's give the businesses in New York the first opportunity. Of course, that works very well in a geography where there's already deep internet penetration, but maybe less so in a geography where internet penetration is growing rapidly. Next slide, please. So among the challenges, obviously there's many ways set up to just circumvent these kinds of restrictions, and proxy services are like readily available and promoted on the internet, and who is privacy services and so on. And even if in your regulations you say that you won't allow who is privacy, it's very difficult to actually stop somebody getting their cousin or their attorney or somebody to register a domain who's based in a country in order for them to operate it. And in fact, when NORED in Norway tried to stop the people doing .co.no by claiming that it was being run by a non-Norwegian company, the people that were running it actually took NORED to court and beat them by saying, well, yes, it is registered by a Norwegian resident, it's just operated by someone else. But we do see a particular answer, which is open TLD, closed SLD, which I'll take you through in a minute. So I've been talking about what I call de jure closed registries, which are closed in principle, but actually many are closed in practice, many because they don't use EPP. So essentially, virtually no registrars can actually sell their domains. We can go to the next slide. But then there are many that do use EPP, but they're still essentially closed because they don't sell any domains. We can go to the next slide. And one of the reasons is what I call the utility myth, where the registry says, look, I provide the domains, it's up to the market to provide the demand, and so they don't do any marketing, they don't do any outreach, and that obviously means that they're essentially closed. Next slide, please. So other factors are the registrars, that there aren't sufficient registrars. Now, sometimes that's because there isn't enough local demand to support the registrars, but it can also be because of what we call the passive income myth, that the registrars also aren't investing in customer acquisition. They're just waiting for the customers to come to them. And the result of that is there are literally tens of thousands of resellers all over the world who are dormant, with all these people who dreamt they would make a fortune out of selling domain names, and then we realised actually you have to invest significant money to make money, and so they stopped. Next slide, please. I just wanted to mention here Africa.com is actually launching an Africa-wide registrar, which is specifically set up to overcome some of these issues and bring a global quality registrar practice to try and sell all CCTLDs across Africa and, of course, others like the city domains, .africa and so on. And OPE, who's just started working there, is here in the audience, and I know they're sponsoring the dinner tonight as well. So you'll have a chance to talk to them then. Other reasons that they're closed is... basically, if you set up a registry in one country that only sells one CCTLD, it's not very attractive to registrars outside of your country to integrate with you, because if they integrate with, say, us instead, they'll get 70 domains instead of just one. On to the next slide, please. So I think we've talked about that. If we can just skip through to... I just wanted to show you something else. Next slide, please. Here. So just with .la, we have a very simple solution that we operate. They run a closed registry in their country. So on .com.la, .gov.la, they've got their own dispute mechanisms. They've got their own registrars. They staff it themselves. They bill in local currencies. It's essentially run exactly the way they want it. Next slide, please. But at the same time, we market the .la globally for them, and that way they benefit from the revenues from that. So just can you just flick through the next couple of slides? So we go to all these registrars. Next page, please. We've built a registrar for Los Angeles for them. Next slide. This is what's up in LA at the moment. We've got this big billboard campaign up. Next slide, please. This is press from this week and the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal and so on. Next slide, please. And we're also doing the same thing in China, where .la, la actually is like an exclamation mark. So in China, the slogan is make your website loud. And then last slide. And lastly, you guys might all be thinking, yeah, well, they are lucky enough to have .la, the name of the third largest English-speaking city in the world. But, say, with .pw, far from obvious, we've actually sold 250,000 domains in the first 6 months, which is more than, say, .me, .asia and so on sold in the first year. So you can do it with virtually any CCTLD. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. I have Jim, on who is in for in a borderless environment. Jim Calvin, thereafter to be Mohammed Diop.
Thank you very much. So far, all the discussion has focused on domain names themselves and various dispute mechanisms for the registration. In a larger context, this discussion is about registration data, and I want to talk a little bit about all of the rest of the registration data that goes with domain names and an issue there to be sensitive to and pay attention to, in particular, translation and transliteration. So taking one small step back, though, the agenda speaks to who is info in a borderless environment. And the first thing that I want to do is remind everyone about SSAC 51. It's document 51 from the SSAC list of documents where we talk about the structure and taxonomy of who is, and observe that the term who is really used to represent three different things, one of which is the registration data itself, one of which is the protocol that's used to access the registration data, which in the technical context actually does have the name who is, and then directory services. So the whole issue of presentation of the data and what data is presented and who has access to that particular data that's presented. And in the translation and transliteration context, I think an issue that people have to be aware of here, and this affects your legal system, is what happens when you want to allow other scripts and other languages in your registration data. What happens when you have a user who you could reasonably state should have the opportunity to make their registration, enter their postal address and whatever other contact information they want to enter, put that in their local language? Why is it that they should have to learn English in order to make this happen? Now, there are obviously already registrars that handle some of this, but none of this is actually explicitly allowed by the ICANN rules for GTLDs. So an interesting question that comes up, though, is if you are going to allow people to use a local language to begin a registration, what happens when law enforcement and other interested parties, even intellectual property parties, are looking to have access to that registration data? And who is responsible for translating that information or transliterating it into something that they can use and they can work with? The UDRP processes have a mechanism for specifying a language for use during those processes. But what happens when the data itself is not in a common language for use by all the parties to it? Okay, and who has the obligation to make all of that work and make it available? And then more generally, on the directory services side, just want to call out, to the extent that people are looking for issues that they should pay attention to, you should also be taking note of the expert working group on directory services that has been launched by ICANN. This group has posted a preliminary proposal for a model that they're going to use going forward, and everything we think we know about who is, all three of the data, protocol, and directory services are now open and subject to change. And there's a public comment period that's open with respect to their model. And this is something that you should pay attention to. You should expect that new GTLDs, and ultimately one should expect existing GTLDs, are going to be obligated to follow these new rules, whatever they become. So it will become important for all of these processes and all parties to a domain name registration to pay attention to what that model is going to become, because it will have an effect on you. It's also interesting to note that there are two new activities that are just kicking off in the ICANN arena. In the GNSO, they have started a process to charter a new working group, a PDP process, for translation and transliteration requirements and what that really means. This is in response to the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group, which finished up a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, and one of the recommendations in that particular report was, in fact, to decide where this activity should take place. So if you're a registrar or if you're a registry, you are going to want to pay attention to this particular PDP, because it will decide whether you have responsibilities and obligations to do translation or transliteration on registration data. So you should watch for that charter to come out and for that PDP process to kick off. Another thing to pay attention to is that ICANN just announced, I think it was even just 2 or 3 days ago, another working group. They're doing a call for volunteers to look at requirements as a follow-up to all the rest of the Who Is review team recommendations. If you followed that activity and that report ended the end of last year, there were 16 recommendations, I believe, in there. A number of them have already been addressed and have gotten some attention. But there is now all the rest of the set of them, and one of those requirements is to specify a data model for internationalized registration data as part of looking at the requirements on translation and transliteration and all the related systems. So these are activities that are important, and you should be paying attention to them. The requirements today are pretty well stated. I mean, if you look at what's required of GTLDs and accredited registrars and accredited registries, the technical requirements for these things are all fairly well stated today, and we've been hearing a lot about the legal processes that are in place for managing these things. But all of this is subject to change. And so this is, you should be looking towards the future and thinking about what's to come. And if you want to actively engage in these processes and help guide what they turn into, this is the time and your opportunity to do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. You saved us plus 3 minutes. Mohamed Diop.
Thank you, Chairman. It's always hard to speak last because I think that people are so tired that I'm not pretty sure that they have sufficient energy to follow the presentation we have for the last speaking. But I think that people have raised a couple of issues on the WHOIS. Some of them are technical. Some others are more about what's going on, like the revision of the existing WHOIS protocol. I think that the last presentation from Jim raised the evolution that we're facing with the WHOIS protocols. But let's come back on another topic that was not discussed sufficiently, is the responsibility. There was, if we look at in what law enforcement are doing in Europe and in the US, and if you look at the relationship of law enforcement and people who are working in the DNS industry in Africa, you will see that it's two different topics. For one main reason, because there is in any process there is a history, and I think that when people start talking about cybercrime and cybersecurity, they see that they need a strong collaboration between law enforcement organization, between the police and all these organizations, and the registry and the registrar in European organization, in the US environment. This is how it works. In Africa, we don't have such things happening because the people who are working in law enforcement mechanism, when they talk to them regarding cybersecurity, it's only about cyber terrorism. And the agenda is not their agenda. The agenda is the agenda that other organizations are pushing to them. Let me just be frank with you. In October, there was a meeting organized in Senegal by the DOJ, United States, Department of Justice. They come to organize just a meeting for law enforcement mechanism between the police, the army, and some of the organization in the US to let them understand what are the new threats in the cyber security world. So their first issue for them is all about terrorism. When we talk about who is data cyber security in Africa, the first agenda is not necessarily cyber terrorism. What we want is to be able to address the issue of registering data for end users as we do in the mobile industry. People get their mobile SIM card, they got numbers, they need to register because they need to have identity. They need to be followed and they have some interaction and they have some legal impact. And if you buy a SIM card and you don't register, you don't put your ID, they give you some delay and they disconnect you. So this is what's happening on the mobile industry. On the IT side, since there is not a strong coordination and cooperation, and people did not see the evolution of the organization that are involved in this process, we did not see any discussion going between the police, the registrars, the CCTLDs, because we did not help them organize that business, and we need to organize them. We need to create such discussion. We need to create such place for this coordination. And not only thinking about cyber terrorism when we talk about data, securing data, and users' registration. And this is a huge area where we need to challenge ourselves. It's not easy. But why I raise this point? Because when it comes to sort two problems that are very local, renewal domain names. People register domain name in our environment with emails that after 3 months, 4 months, when you try to send them an email for renewal of the domain name, the email will no longer work. First problem. If you try to see if there is any address that these people are using in order to be reachable, this is the second problem we got in the Huiz. You're not able to reach back people who register because the address they are putting are not valid. And we know that the first point of contact in Africa, we are 1 billion people, the first point of contact is not a physical address, is a mobile phone now. And the Huiz data, the way it is working now, did not take that one as the point of contact with people. So we got a huge problem in Africa when we want to talk to our customers. Because the only point of contact, and that one is not also 100% reliable because the phone number can be disconnected as well. But it is the easiest way that you can get connected with end users. When you want to make any discussion with the customer, who is was supposed to help you do that? But in fact, the non-accuracy of who is data in Africa, not only in Africa, but worldwide, is a big issue. Specifically in Africa, where addresses is not the first point of contact of end users. So these are some of the points that I just want to highlight, to show that when we talk about who is, regarding on which side we're talking, from the demand side or from the supply side or from the cooperation side regarding identification of users for any legal purposes or any law enforcement mechanism, we are stuck. We don't have such coordination existing. We don't have such collaboration between the different actors who work on the DNS industry to make these things becoming more and more relevant for other organizations to approach us and talk to us and make us as part of the deal. This is very important because if you look at what happened in the past, Interpol was not created from scratch. Interpol have been created because some issues go beyond borders and people see that there is a need to set up an organization that's going to help them coordinate things when issues go beyond borders. The same thing have to happen in Africa. We are not used to talk to policemen. We are not used to talk to jurisdictions before. But because of the internet bring all these new issues on the table, we need to be more responsible. That's why registrars and CCTLDs have to understand more about the responsibility and the level of implication that their role is supposed to play if we want to sort out this issue. That's why we need to be, more structured to face this type of problem we're facing in the continent. So this increase the level of, people need to be more organized. People need to be more responsive because the level of implication of the domain name industry, it impacts our whole economy. And we are part of that discussion. But if you are not there, if you are not well structured, if you are not collaborative enough, this discussion will never happen. And that is our new challenges in the new area of cybercrime, cybersecurity, who is data accuracy, and all these issues become really huge problem that non-organization can tackle together, just alone. It has to be a process of collaboration, of coordination that go beyond nations, beyond the African continent, and that become really global issues. So this is just the some of the topic I was just trying to highlight that make the WHOIS problem not only a local problem. And I think that the fact that IDN become another area because of the language we're using and because of the Arabic and all these implementation of Amharic and all these things in the DNS system will make things more complicated. But I think that if we structure the way we're working, we'll be able to face the need of that challenges that is the evolution of the WHOIS system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mohammed. You also saved us a bit of time. Thank you for that. I think in terms of time, we are, in any case, we started behind time. I don't know if there are any questions or comments to directed to any of the presenters or speakers here, or if people are just ready to get on by. There's a hand. I suppose everybody who wants to ask a question should come close to the mic so they may ask a question. Paulus, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. It's related to CCDODs that were registered or became operational before ICANN came into being. So the case is very similar to legacy space for IP addresses, the addresses that were registered or allocated before ICANN came into being. For IP addresses, those addresses are not, well, the RIRs like AFRINIC are not able to apply their policies or legal framework on those spaces. So it's like space which is untouchable by the RIRs. Now, I want just to hear the feeling on the panel. We have, I think, one or two in Africa CCTLDs like this. What is the legal view for such CCTLDs? Do they fall under the ICANN framework? Can ICANN policies address them?
There's an open question. It is an open question. I don't know who is eager to take that question and respond to the question in this panel. Mohammed Diop, and suppose somebody else will follow.
Paulus, I think that it's, I'm not trying to answer the question, but I'm not trying to follow you on the on your thought. I mean, people who get the CCTLD delegation are managing, many of them have started a couple of years ago, some others are recent, but in fact the relationship that I can have with the CCTLD is that after the delegation of the CCTLD, they attempt to get this accountability framework where some of them accept to sign, some others did not accept to sign. But in fact, this doesn't prevent that the way that the system works is not a new protocol. I mean, since the beginning, this WHOIS protocol is have been implemented and data have been collected. So what's happening now is the evolution of the level of data that people are asking to complete or not. But since the beginning, I mean, you are not registering domain name without having this information available. So what I'm saying is the policy apply to everybody. I mean, if you want to change your data, this change would not apply if you are not compliant with the principle of the protocol as it is, the set of rules that have to be documented before the change is accepted. So that's why your question regarding the policy, I don't know if it is only regarding the accuracy of the WHOIS data or not, or if people who have been the CCTLD that have started operation before ICANN, did they have and who registered domain name that did not follow the rules, did they have to update it or not? I think that the name have been registered using the WHOIS protocol update at that format, and I don't think that this information is no longer valid. It is still valid. So I'm not seeing the new purpose of the WHOIS putting some data off of the protocol that have been already registered. We can think about some add-on, but not necessarily removing things out of the initial registration. Jim,
did you have a follow-up question, Paulus?
You covered.
Jim want to add something?
If I understand the question and the context of your question, you're asking about grandfathering, issues related to grandfathering of existing data, CCT operations, that kind of thing, right? I mean, a registration was created under particular terms of service, particular rules and processes. What happens when those change? Is that correct?
These maybe two or three CCT audits, they have never been rederogated in the process. So there is some claim that the four are outside the current ICANN legal framework, just like legacy space for IP addresses does. Right. So I was just asking for a view on it.
Okay. I mean, I guess the only short comment I would make in general is just that ccTLDs voluntarily choose to follow or not follow ICANN processes today. I mean, they're encouraged. There are a lot that do. There are a lot that come very close. So for those that don't, you know, they still have that privilege and the opportunity to do that. So.
Thank you, Jim. Before I let you then to ask a question, there's up on the screen the survey that meeting attendants or people who've been attending today are asked to fill in. It's about the quality of this meeting that we are holding. So if in the last few minutes before we log off, if people can quickly try and answer that survey. Then.
I think there's somebody at the back, actually, first.
Sorry. Thank you. Je vais parler en français. Ça dérange personne. Juste un carboniste de l'AFNIC, comment je me présente. Juste un petit commentaire et merci beaucoup aux intervenants d'avoir clarifié ce point juste il y a quelques secondes. Dans l'ensemble des présentations qu'on a vues, on a pu penser par moment que les règles qui ont été mises en place dans le cadre de l'ICANN, que ce soit les UDRP avec WIPO, que ce soit une certaine manière de considérer le WIS s'appliquait à tous. Non, elle s'applique aux parties qui ont des contrats spécifiques avec l'ICANN, ce qui n'est pas le cas de tous les CCTLD. Donc cette clarification, je voulais la faire. Ça ne veut pas dire qu'il n'y ait pas un intérêt à la convergence, évidemment, mais on ne peut pas dire aujourd'hui à des opérateurs de CC... de toute façon, vous n'avez pas le choix. Il va falloir que vous appliquiez l'UDRP telle qu'elle a été décrite, ou il va falloir que vous utilisiez le WIS tel que l'ICANN voudrait qu'on l'utilise. Et de ce point de vue, je voudrais juste faire donner un exemple. C'est l'exemple de l'anonymat. Il y a un certain nombre de CCTLD qui ont décidé, pour respecter leur législation nationale, que les utilisateurs physiques puissent être anonymes dans le WIS. C'est une grosse différence avec le WIS général qu'on peut trouver dans les GTLD. C'est d'ailleurs un différent que l'ICANN peut avoir avec les organismes de protection des données personnelles. Et c'est bien la preuve qu'on peut vivre avec différents systèmes qui soient plus ou moins adaptés à la réalité locale. Donc ça, je voulais vraiment le dire, parce qu'il faut quand même faire attention à ce qu'on puisse développer son industrie localement en respectant ses lois et ses règles locales. Et dernier point que j'aurais voulu aborder de ce point de vue-là, c'est également les règles de résolution des litiges où on a parlé du droit des propriétaires de marques. Il y a aussi le droit des titulaires de nom de domaine qu'il faut prendre en compte. Et parfois, le droit du titulaire de nom de domaine s'oppose frontalement au droit du titulaire de marque.
So, sorry, man. If you may try and wrap up your contribution in the interest of time, if it's a question in the next 30 seconds, please.
Okay, that was just a comment, but I was just speaking slowly for the translation, so I'm going to speak quickly. Just telling that we have talked about the trademark owners when talking about UDRP, but we should also talk about registrant rights, and in some countries, this is easier to talk about using a website in good faith than talking about trademark rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. So sorry having to push you like that without warning you first. I think that point, let's note it for now. I will take the next two questions and then I'll allow the panel to respond to that contribution that you've just made. Let's go.
Okay, I'm relaying a question from the Adobe Connect chat from Chaitanya D, and the question is really to Jim and Mohammed: how can you ensure privacy / limit spam if Whois is made accurate?
If we can note that question, Mohammed, and also panelists, I would like to take the question. There's a question at the back there.
Yes, very quickly. The first one is a question. The second one is a comment. The first question to .pw, what steps are being taken, if any, to address increasing spam from .pw, as reported by Symantec this year? The second one is in terms of the discussion on law enforcement security with respect to Whois accuracy. I thought just very quickly, when the first director of the FBI, John Edgar Hoover, when he took office, one of the first things that he set out to do was to create a central repository to be able to identify fingerprints database. I know that's completely separate from Whois, and it's probably unrelated, but in essence, I note the last panelist's comments in relation to when you were saying that the two are sort of distinct, like you're talking about access, you're talking about Whois accuracy and with respect to security. And I thought that, just very quickly, and I'll wrap up my comment, I thought that they're actually two facets of the same cube, but one of the challenges that's now open for the community is in terms what is the extent in which security is permissible, noting that there are complex multi-jurisdictional treatments and processes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take your question, sir, and then thereafter, if there's another question, it will have to follow after the panelists have responded here.
Yes, thanks. I'll be very brief, Nigel Hicks and ICANN. Really, it was just to address the UDRP issue and other mechanisms that are currently in place. And it was very interesting to hear some of the history of when these mechanisms were put in place. They were obviously put in place in a slightly different environment that we have today and are going to have in the next couple of years. And I just wanted to ask really the panel's views on whether we need to evolve sort of new thinking about the whole dispute resolution area in this new domain space that we're entering into, or whether the existing mechanisms will suffice. Thank you.
Thank you. Another panelist noted the questions and comments made. I'm going to start next to me with Ben Crawford. I think there was a question or two directed to you, where the one was with .pw.
So thank you for that question. Obviously, having registered so many domains so fast, We found, unfortunately, among the first registrants who were quickest to use it were spammers, whereas obviously legitimate users of domain names tend to take a little bit longer to build their websites and so on. But .pw in its policies has a zero tolerance of spam, so what that means is that the domains are deactivated as soon as they're reported. 5,000 have already been deactivated. We use every monitoring service available in order to quickly and rapidly take them down. If ever you are spammed from anything from a PW domain, you can go to the PW website and report it, and it will be deactivated.
Thanks. I will respond very quickly to I can remember, I think it was the second, to the gentleman who spoke French, and then this will be a link also to make a comment on Nigel's question. So, of course, we need to think of registrants, and that's why balance is so very important. The domain name case law outside the UDRP, through traditional routes, it's still developing, and it will continue to develop. The U.S. courts have deliberated that domain names are property rights, and as property rights, registrants have legal rights based on that proprietization of domain names against abuses. So even though we don't see the UDRP recognizing this, there is recourse that can be taken in the US, but we also see in Europe, Germany and the UK are developing slowly a case law, and I'm sure that also within the African region it will start as domain names get populated and they become more and more used, cases will appear before the court. So, particularly in the context of CCTLDs, this is what I was trying to convey when I was saying that the internet is a great space for opportunities. And one of the things, and CCTLDs need to be available beyond trademark rights. And one of the key issues here is also relates to local content. CCTLDs can host and can support local content, thus they're becoming more and more important for that aspect. And going back to Nigel, I don't think I have an answer, and it is a very big question and issue. However, the UDRP is the oldest ICANN policy. It has never been reviewed. You're right when you say that it was created in a time where we didn't really know or we didn't understand, we didn't have the full picture of what domain names were, how they were interacting with trademarks, what were the boundaries, what are the parameters. 12, 13 years down the road, we are gaining more and more experience, and this experience also comes from the traditional route and court litigation, where there is a plethora of ideas of what domain names are, how they should be used, and what their scope should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Konstantinos. Jim?
Thank you. So I want to respond holistically to the last set of questions and comments that have been made, and make four points, if I can. So the first is to speak a little bit about Afilias, my organization. We are a registry service provider hosting, 18 TLDs. And we have several TLDs for which we are the registry operator, not just the service provider. One of those is .info, which I bring up because it represents a success story in managing abusive registrations, whatever the reason for the abuse is, even registrations that are created by inaccurate data. When the anti-phishing working group started its semi-annual report about the status of malicious domain names, .info was always at the very top of those lists and was an awkward place to be. As soon as we appeared there in that first case, we immediately created, and we now have, I believe, we have the longest-running anti-abuse security service that we offer for all the TLDs that we host if they want it. For those for which we're not the operator, it's really up to that operator to choose whether they want that service or not. Then, of course, it would be available for new GTLDs also. So we quite proactively seek out looking for registrations that need to be taken care of, whether it's for law enforcement requests or whatever other kind of issue might pop up. So this is a problem which can be dealt with, is my main message there, and it's possible to deal with this, and different organizations do different things. The second thing I want to comment about is registration data accuracy, since that was brought up. ESAC, the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, and ICANN, of which I'm actually the vice chair, published a document about the taxonomy of validation and what it means. And we talked about three different types of validation and verification for who is data. I think that it's important to keep those things in mind. We talk about factual validation. So just talking about whether or not you're getting data that, in fact, is of the form it's supposed to. Does an email address look like an email address or not? Does it look like a phone number? Am I getting digits? That kind of thing. There's functional validation, where you can talk about, does the email address work? Does the phone number actually work? Can I make a call to it? And then, of course, the third thing was identity validation, where you talk about whether or not that data can be corroborated to represent a physical identity, whether that's an organization or a person. I think one of the things that always concerns me about talking about registration data accuracy is people like to talk about it, and they talk about it at the same time when they talk about privacy and spam and abuse of the data. And I think it's important that we separate those two issues, to separate registration data accuracy, which is a valid, I believe, and important thing for everyone to do. There really isn't any reason why you shouldn't have knowledge about your customer. If you're the registrar, you should want to know who you're doing business with. This seems like a fairly obvious thing. Most people would agree with that. I never found anyone who disagreed with that point. But we shouldn't tie it to the fact that we also have to deal with various kinds of issues and the reasons why people put bad data out there. So my second point, just in summary, is registration data accuracy is something we should all seek to achieve, and we should be clear about what we're talking about, and that's why I pushed about the ESAC document on who is validation taxonomy. Third thing to talk about is privacy. I think that privacy is a separate issue and can be dealt with separately. Privacy services and proxy services came into existence, arguably, for all of the wrong reasons. But there are certainly some valid and legitimate reasons for these things to exist. And if you start from the premise that you've got reasonable data, you can then look at it as a technical problem. There are reasons why privacy should exist. There are a variety of ways in which one can provide this service, and we should simply engage in a discussion of how to provide that service and make it a documented, well-understood, legitimate service instead of something which came about for reasons that it really shouldn't have. There are part of the problem today with privacy and proxy services is there is no uniformity about them. Different service providers do different things. They behave in different ways. ICANN does not have any set rules for privacy and proxy services. This is one of the things that was called out in the Who Is Review Team report that I mentioned earlier when I was talking. So this is another area that has yet to be dealt with in a clear and coherent way, even in the ICANN community. So it's a legitimate problem, but it should be separated from registration data accuracy and dealt with as its own topic that needs attention. And the fourth thing is about spam. I think that it's often stated that Whois represents a source of data for spammers. So people who like to scrape email addresses and use them. I have not seen any solid evidence that this is the predominant source today of email addresses and scraping them. Most of the providers that I know of for Whois services all have limits on querying Whois services. So it's not actually straightforward to go scraping a directory service like Whois and grab those email addresses. And in today's world, there are a lot of ways to collect email addresses, and spammers can collect them, aside from the fact that they've been collecting addresses for decades, because email has been around for decades. Think about all of the public mailing lists that exist, all the public sources of email addresses, and these things can be much more easily scraped than Whois services. So I'm not suggesting that Whois directory services is not a source of spam email addresses. I'm just suggesting that I don't believe it is the predominant source. And in fact, I've not seen any published statistics that suggest that it is the prominent source of email-based spam. We, in fact, have tried, we in ESSAC, we actually tried to conduct some examination of Whois data at one time several years ago to look and see if we could validate this premise. And in fact, we could not. And I still today have not seen this premise validated. So more generally, I make the observation with spam that associating spam with Whois services and all things related to Whois is just playing on emotions. It's not playing on factual data. And we should be cautious about doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Mohammed, if you can wrap it up in the next few minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be very short because I know that we're running out of time. I will just respond very quickly on two issues that have been raised regarding spam and the accuracy of data. I think that the Jim have gone through more explanation, but what I'm going to add is making the data accurate is just a need because we are interacting with individuals and legal entities, and we want this information to be accurate because we cannot base anything in terms of economy on transaction if you don't make that relationship strong enough. So in the telecommunication industry, they have some law enforcement in many countries where identity need to be bind to these services. So they find, in my country, for example, they pass a law that you cannot have a mobile phone if you cannot link this ID with an ID of somebody or legal or a person or legal entity. So what I'm just trying to say is getting the information accurate doesn't mean that you're going to publish them or make them public. So that's where I have to answer the question of Boris, Pierre Boris, who said that making the information accurate doesn't mean that everybody will access to this information. So if a law inside the country protect users and you have the choice to say that I don't want my information to be public, I think that the protocol allows us to implement it. So these things have to be respect and to be implemented locally. So this is another issue, like making the information available is one thing. Making them accurate is one thing. Getting access to everybody who wants to get access to the information is another issue. And I think that if there is law that protect people on confidentiality data, so these things have to be seriously taken into consideration by local organizations who are dealing in the domain name industry. And I think that this is why this process is so complex, because it's not one size fits all, because we have many things that are happening in local countries that need to be taken into consideration above the rules that we are trying to implement. So our technology have to be really compliant with the local laws that we have in countries, and we need really to see where there is anything, and I do not see anything that will not make our local jurisdiction being applicable on this rule that we have on the Whois service. So thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. And I don't know if I've left any of the panelists out. Dandas is shaking his head. His head is peace for the day. In the absence of any other question or comment, this session comes to a close at 12 minutes past 6. I would like to thank you for your patience and for your endurance to continue this session up until this time. I'm aware that on the program there's a gala dinner at Moyo's restaurant. I thought a gala dinner was trademarked by ICANN. You know? So, but I say it's not yet trademarked. So it's going to be a gala dinner at Moyo's, sponsored by Africa.com. Barak will give us the details.
Thanks, Vika. I think all our moderators and presenters need another round of applause. Let's appreciate them. Yeah, so some housekeeping matters. The buses are waiting for those going to Garden Court, South Beach. The gala dinner starts at 7 p.m., so we just have time to go and drop our bags and get back to the bus so that we are at the venue on time. Tomorrow we begin by 9 a.m. and request that we be here by 8:30 so that the program begins at 9, because by 1 we shall wind up the program for the day. So with that, have a good evening. See you at Moyo Restaurant.